It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Kate Archer-Kent. How do you put a price tag on a life lost to a drug overdose? And who is responsible for the epidemic of prescription drug abuse in the United States? Those were some of the questions raised by lawsuits against the makers and distributors of highly addictive opioid painkillers. Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin, could spend billions of dollars to address the crisis if a settlement deal is approved by a judge in a bankruptcy court this week. But will it mean that everyone in America suffering from an opioid addiction will be able to get treatment? Should company executives be held personally responsible? We're talking about where those lawsuits have ended up and what it means for those who've been harmed. You can join us. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Email us ideas@wpr.org. With us is Jan Hoffman, a reporter who writes about behavioral health and health law for the New York Times. Welcome, Jan.
Good morning.
Good morning. So bring us up to speed on these settlements against opioid manufacturers and distributors. There have been so many lawsuits. Where do things stand currently?
Imagine, let's just say two buckets for now. The Purdue bucket is in a separate area. Okay, we'll talk about the other big bucket, which is for the most part sitting in front of a federal judge in Cleveland, Ohio. That bucket holds thousands of lawsuits from little towns, counties, states, tribes, hospitals, and insurers, as well as other plaintiffs. And that bucket faces easily two dozen companies. The companies break down into three categories. You either make the drug, you truck it across the country, or you dispense it to the patient at your pharmacy. So three kinds of companies are being sued. For the most part, that big bucket in Ohio is slowly being emptied, very slowly. Last month, the three big distributors, the companies that distribute the drugs, and Johnson & Johnson, one of the big manufacturers of the drugs, settled for $26 billion. But that deal is not yet complete.
And so all of these cases, you talk about the federal cases before the judge in Ohio. The intent there was to consolidate them, right? Because there were just so many, as you mentioned, governments across the country who are dealing with the fallout of the epidemic, paying for emergency healthcare services, for child protective services, all of the human services related that counties and towns have to pay for in this crisis.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They're seeking some relief. But as you mentioned, they're starting to get settled. Now, is it still the intent to come up with one global agreement that addresses all of the concerns of all of the governments across the country?
Hope springs eternal. But basically, the global agreement now really has to do with, one company or a couple of companies at a time with a group of plaintiffs. They're never going to settle. It's just not going to happen to have, say, 24 or more companies sitting down and writing the same agreement with thousands of plaintiffs. So, for example, the three big distributors in Johnson & Johnson, if that settlement really does go through, and it ain't a done deal yet, it's pretty close, but it ain't over, they get a quote-unquote global settlement with their plaintiffs. Similarly, tomorrow, a judge is supposed to come down with the final order on Purdue. And if that goes through, Purdue gets a quote unquote global peace with its thousands of plaintiffs.
And how did we get to the point of settlements? Why are we not going to trial? Why are we not seeing these cases on trial?
Well, Well, I think you need to think a little bit about what's involved in getting to trial. Frankly, most plaintiffs and defendants don't want to go to trial because it takes an incredibly long time. It's expensive. And frankly, in Purdue alone, that's just one company. Lawyers have already burned through hundreds of millions of dollars in legal fees that could have been gone to settlement. Going to trial takes much longer. And frankly, going to trial is always a gamble. You don't always get a jury. You may just do it in front of a judge. The standard of proof is high. The laws are rigorous. And either the plaintiff could lose and lose big, or the defendant could lose and lose big. So it's always a very expensive gamble, and it is much more desirable to settle before you get to trial. Of course, the big deterrent, the big downside for the public interest and what gets lost is we, the public, do not get to hear a full accounting of what truly happened. And that happens in open court.
Yes. So as you mentioned, there's an interest by both parties in reaching a deal on behalf of the companies. The company's looking to bring an end to this, and the government's looking to not spend legal fees that they perhaps don't have on lawsuits that can last and are lasting years.
Years.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about this settlement, so you mentioned $26 billion on the table with Johnson & Johnson. What is that?
That's four companies.
Four companies, 20. Including Johnson & Johnson. Where's that money going to go?
I'll tell you where it's going to go or where it should be going according to the deals. But I can't help repeating, and I know it sounds a little bit like a broken record, that there are a lot of hurdles to get to jump over before the money starts, before anyone writes a check.
Right. We're not even there yet.
Oh, we are so not there yet. Mm-hmm. We are so not there yet. And this at a time where, as you correctly pointed out, during the pandemic, deaths from overdoses to both street and prescription opioids were the highest they've ever been. So we are truly in an emergency situation and checks need to be cut. But that said, according to the settlements that are being written, the money is supposed to go very specifically to funds that allocate for treatment, for prevention, for all kinds of services to what's known as abate the opioid epidemic. And there are guardrails, monitors in place to assure that what happens to this money does not happen to what happened to the big tobacco money, which was basically disappeared into state budgets and used to fix potholes and all sorts of other non-tobacco related problems.
Right. That is on my mind as we're talking about the urgency of addressing this epidemic that has been going on for years, has cost so many lives, and yet we're in this protracted legal battle with all of these companies, maybe approaching the finish line, that we can maybe see a finish line in the horizon.
I hate to say it. I don't want to pour cold water on your hopes. although as a journalist, isn't that my job? But I talked to a number of lawyers who said that they think they're maybe about a third of the way through.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And really, checks are not flowing yet. The hurdles to finalize the deal with the big three distributors in Johnson & Johnson could take a year.
Wow.
And that includes getting buy-in from every single state saying okay, and all the communities in the United States who sued saying okay.
Yeah, a whole lot to talk about there.
Even then, if they agree, the payments for that money come out over 18 years.
Mm. Mm. We are speaking with New York Times reporter Jan Hoffman, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about massive opioid settlements pending across America. What consequences do you think pharmaceutical companies should face for the opioid epidemic? We're discussing this with New York Times reporter Jan Hoffman, and you can join us. We're at 1-800-642-1234 or ideas@wpr.org. So, Jan, we were talking about these settlements that are perhaps years off in the horizon, yet we have this raging epidemic. We have people that need treatment. We have governments that are being affected by the burden of handling this pandemic. And we have these settlements on the horizon. So I want to talk about Purdue Pharma. We mentioned briefly the Johnson & Johnson and other distributors. We have this separate settlement deal with Purdue Pharma that has made its way to bankruptcy court, and we are expecting the ruling on that imminently. What do you expect to see out of that bankruptcy judge's decision?
It should. Well, it was supposed to happen numerous times already, but currently it's scheduled for tomorrow morning, where the bankruptcy judge is expected to approve. This is now the 10th amended version of the bankruptcy plan that will break up Purdue Pharma as we know it, rebuild it into a different company, and extract a fair chunk of change from its now soon to be former owners, the Sackler family.
And so as part of this settlement, they would agree to pay governments over $4 billion over the course of 9 years. And they would not accept any admission of wrongdoing. Is that right?
Yeah. Correct. Correct.
So where does that leave us? As far as who's responsible for this crisis, has that been addressed?
Well, I guess it's a very complicated question, and it's one of the reasons these cases are so difficult to press, because there are so many actors in the tragedy, and this is not saying, for example, that any company shouldn't be held liable. But you need to think about the fact that these medications were approved by the federal government. So they play a certain role in this.
Right.
The distribution of billions of pills was supposed to be monitored by the Drug Enforcement Administration. So they play a role. The manufacturers made the pills. They pushed the pills. The distributors took orders from the pharmacies. They should have known that there were grotesquely outsized orders. And the pharmacists looked in the eyes of the patients who were frequent flyers. Never mind the doctors themselves who were writing the scripts.
Prescribing them. Yep.
Yeah. So we talk about responsibility. And I don't think any of those actors, as I said, in the tragedy should evade responsibility, but apportioning responsibility when there are so many different participants is a really difficult task. And that's partly why the litigation has been going on for so long, because everybody is pointing fingers at everyone else.
Yes. Well, I want to go to the phones now and talk to Steve in Oshkosh, who has had a personal experience with the issue. Good morning, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, I broke my leg January of last year. Bad break. Had to have surgery and stay overnight in the hospital. and the doctor prescribed oxycodone, which I refused to accept and begged the doctor to prescribe an alternative. He wouldn't give me any alternative. It was oxycodone or anything. I ended up going home with nothing but aspirin. I think it was aspirin or maybe it was Tylenol. And I couldn't even get an ice bag. And so, you know, there was no alternative to oxycodone.
You know, it's interesting about that. I actually had a similar experience. I mean, I've been writing about these stories for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And I've had surgeries and the surgeon insisted on sending me home with opioids and I refused. And I was so angry. I mean, they sent me home for a minor procedure with 40 pills. I was so angry. I wrote to the head of the anesthesiology department and the head of surgery and said, you know, you're a lawsuit waiting to happen. How dare you do this? And I completely appreciate your rage and frustration. I will tell you one thing that's I think is very interesting about Americans versus Europeans. Europeans have a much lower problem with opioids than Americans do. And one reason people put forth for that is that they have different expectations of pain than Americans do. Mm. They expect for surgery to be painful. And they are told that they will at some point get over it. Now, of course, we're talking pain is a huge umbrella term. You know, there's chronic pain and then there's acute pain. But Europeans in general are told that pain is to be expected with surgery. Americans are told they shouldn't have any pain. And so somewhere in the middle, there has to be some sort of mediated moment where you say, you know, it's going to hurt. We can make it hurt a little less, but we don't want to guarantee that you'll have no pain.
We could.
But these are all issues that not only doctors need to think about, but frankly, something I looked in as well is that addiction medicine is not really taught in mainstream medical schools. And that's an area that really young doctors need to be educated about.
Yes.
And I'm so sorry, Steve, that you had to go through that because you knew better than your doctor.
Yeah, thank you, Steve, for your call and sharing your experience. And I feel like it is so common. I know that there have been experiences in my family similar to the ones you described, Jan. And I wonder, did anything ever come? Did you get a response back from the hospital or anyone about the practice?
I got an apology, and then I had to have another meniscus tear repaired in the other knee a few years later. And believe me, I got the same pitch. I think what I find so enraging is that the due diligence here is being performed by patients rather than doctors. Yeah. The fact that Steve, that I have to tell doctors, no, you should not give me this medicine. I mean, that seems to me totally upside down.
And to be clear, none of that will change necessarily as a result of these settlements, of these agreements. Is that right?
Well, you know, one can only hope. You know, me, it's as I said, it's my job to pour cold water on hope, but I do hope. I do hope that there will be better education in medical schools, that hospitals will be more rigorous, that frankly, I have heard in the works, there is a new legal theory being tested, which puts the burden on emergency rooms to show that they have offered interventions when they see someone overdosing to begin to treat their addiction, and that if they don't, they can be sued. Mm-hmm. So if something like that goes forward, I think it would begin to force medical systems to be much more astute about how they handle addiction, propensities toward addiction, and related problems. But I, you know, in closing, you know, I know we have to jump off in a second. I want to give a shout out because I think a huge swath of people who were not really accorded, frankly, compassion in all these settlements are the families and the victims themselves. We've talked about government suing.
Yes.
About entity suing, but 500,000 people have died in some sort of relation to overdoses, to prescription and illegal opioids in the last 20 years. And the voices of those families have largely been shut out of the litigation.
Well, Jan, we will have to have you back to dive into that question and more. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for asking the good questions. They need to be pressed always. So thank you and stay safe.
Thanks. Jan Hoffman writes about behavioral health and health law for the New York Times. Up next is news. Then we're talking about helping your students back into the classroom. I'm Molly Stentz, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.